Sounds like your typical protest, right? It wasn't. This was a clever way of getting around tightening restrictions on demonstrations and free speech in a country that for a long time has had a pretty robust democracy. So here's what happened. This was in Seoul, South Korea, in February. Amnesty Korea wanted to stage a street protest against the ongoing erosion of civil rights under President Park. Police turned down the request, saying it would block traffic. The protesters said, "How about if we use holograms?" In other words, protesters won't be there. This will just be projected images of light. That won't block traffic. And the police said, okay. But this has to be strictly a cultural event. If anyone shouts along with the holographic protesters, we'll go after them. So the ghost protesters were given half an hour. They called for the right to protest, the right to fight for South Korea to remain a full, robust democracy. President Park appears determined to move in the opposite direction, and she's not the only leader in the world who is.
We're talking about a recession of democraticness, of the extent, vigor of freedom and democracy in the world.
This is Larry Diamond, a political sociologist at the Hoover Institution, speaking last year at a National Endowment for Democracy event.
And secondly, I think the resolve, the willingness that was there for a long time of the established democracies in the world to promote democracy and defend democracy is really in serious and alarming retreat. Alarming because I believe we are in a period of recession of freedom, let's say, and it really needs a lot of help and defense. And I'm really worried. I think we're on the cusp of something very, very dark and frightening.
His former student, Stephen Levitsky, who's now a Harvard professor of government studying authoritarian and democratic regimes, was on the same panel, but he had a different take.
Couple of points on the democratic recession that isn't. First of all, many of the democratic breakdowns that we've seen over the last decade have been either partially or fully reversed. Nepal's 2005 coup was reversed. Mali's coup was reversed. Yanukovych fell in Ukraine. Electoral rule was restored in Honduras. And it looks like Sri Lanka's autocratic turn may also be reversed. So while there have been some democratic breakdowns in the last decade, what's really striking, in my view anyway, is how few of them turned out to be long-term authoritarian reversions.
In fact, Stephen Levitsky says, there are as many democracies in the world now as a decade ago, and as some democracies have eroded or broken down, others have gotten stronger. So are we in an era of democratic recession or resilience or a messy mix of both? This is Whose Century Is It?, a podcast about ideas, trends, and twists shaping the 21st century. I'm Mary Kay Magstead. I've been in more than one conversation of late, perhaps you have too, where people are gloomy about the state of democracy around the world. They tick off countries that are becoming more authoritarian: China, Russia, Turkey, Thailand, Egypt, Venezuela. They look with anxiety at populist cheerleaders for xenophobia, like Donald Trump in the US and Marine Le Pen in France. But what you see when you look at the world depends in part on the frame you choose for looking at it. So reasonable people could make very different arguments, as Larry Diamond and Stephen Levitsky just showed. But also, Americans tend to have a frame that goes something like this.
The survival of liberty in our land increasingly depends on the success of liberty in other lands.
This is President George W. Bush in his second inaugural address. And here's President Obama when he was a presidential candidate.
The separation of powers works. Our Constitution works. We will again set an example for the world that the law is not subject to the whims of stubborn rulers and that justice is not arbitrary.
So the American frame? Democracy is good for America and for the world. America should strive to make the world safe for democracy. That goes right back to Woodrow Wilson a century ago when he urged Congress to allow the U.S. to enter World War I. The idea was America should lead by example, intervene when appropriate, and people around the world would grab democracy with both hands as soon as they were given a choice. Well, to a point. I lived in China for years as a foreign correspondent, and I often heard Chinese people say, As long as the government's doing a good job and I have room to live my life the way I want to, it doesn't matter if I can vote. In fact, I've heard urban, educated Chinese say, if everyone can vote, things are going to be chaotic. Farmers just don't know enough to vote wisely. Now, before you judge, that was how democracy was practiced in its early stages in America, too. White men with land got the vote. Everyone else had to wait, decades or centuries. But this is modern life, right? So what about the idea that as a middle class arises and a country develops, the pressure for democracy, or at least for more pluralism, increases?
Well, I think a lot of people used to think that way in my field and in other fields, particularly maybe in the 1960s.
This is Bill Hurst, an associate professor of political science at Northwestern University in Chicago, my alma mater.
That was very popular, specifically in the context of the Johnson administration and the Vietnam War, to assume or to argue quite forcefully, in fact, that if countries could develop to a certain critical point of economic growth or per capita income, that they might transition towards a more democratic society. And from the perspective of people like Rostow and others in the administration, away from any path that leads towards a communist regime. Now, in fact, what we see is that that's not always the case. There isn't a clear relationship in which all good things go together, as some have characterized it. And while it may be possible that the development of a middle class is necessary for a more open political system, it certainly isn't sufficient, and I'm not even sure it's necessary.
Bill focuses especially on China and Indonesia and is fluent in both languages. We had a conversation a while back that got me thinking about some of the assumptions we make, that I was making, about when and how democratic transition happens. Among his points were...
Well, I think authoritarian governments are probably the default option in most of history and most of the world. Democracies are the anomalies rather than the norm. We can look at a lot of countries that have had long-term authoritarian governments without any clear signs of disruption. And so moments of transition away from authoritarianism should be treated, I think, as surprises rather than inevitable outcomes.
And he says, even when authoritarian regimes fall, like Marcos in the Philippines in 1986 or Suharto in Indonesia in 1998, the elites, educated, wealthy, influential people, not necessarily the ones holding office, are often able to steer the transition so it protects their interests. In other words, people power sounds great, but democratic transitions are often more complicated than that. Take Indonesia, for example, where I covered the demonstrations that led to the fall of President Suharto in 1998.
And so the crisis that then happened in 1997 and 98 with the Asian financial crisis was not, I don't think, very well anticipated by Suharto or others in the political elite. Once that crisis began, things moved very quickly, and it quickly became clear that Suharto was going to have to go. But that did not mean that the elite was going to lose power. And in fact, many members of the top elite met in 1998 and essentially divided the spoils of democratization such that they all remained in power, even though there was a meaningful transition to a new kind of political election system and system of political parties. To this day, that old elite of the new order period has not been dislodged.
So in Indonesia, the elites still have the upper hand, but within a more open democratic society. In Egypt, where elites, including military elites, worked behind the scenes to reverse the Arab Spring, the opposite happened. The government now is arguably less democratic than Mubarak was. But was this a failure of democracy? I asked Stephen Levitsky, and he said no.
Whenever a regime begins to liberalize or weaken or reform, whether those reforms are genuine, whether those reforms are window dressing, whether those reforms are driven, and this was often the case in the 1990s, by the state going bankrupt and the regime essentially collapsing, we assume that it's democratization. And it's not always democratization. Authoritarian regimes fall and may be replaced by chaos,
They may be replaced by other authoritarian regimes, like in Iran in 1979 or in Nicaragua in 1979, or they may be replaced by democracies. But there is no reason, either theoretically or empirically, to conflate change or reform or the breakdown of an authoritarian regime with democratization. And the problem is that for decades, observers, particularly those linked to the U.S. establishment, have been too optimistic, have had this almost teleological view that when things start to change, democratization is coming. And then when things stop, when change stops, either because the regime doesn't need to reform anymore, because it's strengthened, because maybe the economy got better, or when things don't turn out to go in a unilateral direction towards democratization, we assume that it's rollback. But it may be that they were never on the road to democratization to begin with.
So what are the factors that indicate if a country that's not a democracy has a decent chance of becoming one? Can you generalize, or is it different in each case?
Well, there's no theory that predicts democratization everywhere. I think there are two variables that are critical. One variable that certainly helps a lot is a certain level of economic development. It's certainly not impossible for poor countries to become democratic. They often do. But it's very, very likely that once a country reaches middle-income status, becomes, you know, highly urbanized, has relatively large middle class, does not make democracy inevitable by any means, but it makes it much, much more likely. So democratization is much more likely in Malaysia and in Singapore than it is in Burundi. The other one I wanted to mention, though, is the capacity of the state. You've got to have a functioning state for democracy to take hold. And what happened in the 1990s with the collapse of communism, and particularly in sub-Saharan Africa, you had many, many, many countries in which states just basically went bankrupt and in many cases just collapsed. And authoritarian regimes collapsed with them. But a country in which the state is literally collapsing and maybe warlords are emerging outside of the capital city and the state can't pay the police and the state can't pay teachers and can't pay bureaucrats and the state is literally coming apart at the seams, you may see elections, you may see an autocrat fall. You are very, very unlikely to see the emergence of a stable democracy, almost impossible without an effective state.
Yeah. What does what happened in 2011 in the Middle East and onward from 2011 tell you about sort of when democracies can take hold in situations like that and when they don't? I mean, in Tunisia, it was successful, and pretty much everywhere else, not so much.
What you certainly had in much of the Middle East, although not all of it, was a number of authoritarian regimes in trouble. That does not mean that democratization is what comes next. What it means is that authoritarian regimes are in trouble. As soon as we saw a wave, we thought and we wrote about and we talked about 1989 in Eastern Europe. 1989 in Eastern Europe sort of spoiled us because it was a full domino effect. Every regime in the region fell within a couple of years, and almost all of them fully democratized. And so we kind of put that lens on and expected it in the Middle East, and we were all collectively, at least in the United States, very disappointed. But there are a lot of reasons, several reasons, why democratization should be particularly hard in the Middle East. One of them is that major powers for decades and to this day continue to support many of the authoritarian regimes. This is most obvious in the Gulf states. That's one reason. Another reason is that regimes in the Middle East have been armed to the teeth for decades by both the West and earlier the Soviet Union. So they all have oversized coercive apparatuses. And a third reason is that many, not all of the states in the Middle East have access to these huge rents, which have allowed them to co-opt a huge chunk of society and really prevent a vibrant and independent private sector and civil society from emerging. So you have a big state, a weak civil society, states that are armed to the teeth, and in many, many cases, regimes that at the end of the day are backed by key powers in the West or the East. So democratization is pretty tough.
And do you think it will remain so? in the Middle East?
There are a handful of cases where I think it's more likely. I mean, there's another factor which I didn't mention, which is the Islamist challenge. In regimes, secular authoritarian regimes like Egypt, you immediately get this problem where opposition forces divide between, broadly speaking, liberal middle class and Islamists. And when the liberal middle class perceives itself to be threatened by Islamists, then it's going to back the military, as occurred in Egypt. And that can happen in a number of cases. That happened in Algeria 25 years ago. So where might it happen? I mean, I think Iran has an okay chance at democratization. It's a strong regime, an effective state. It's a revolutionary regime that still has a lot of coercive punch. But it has a much more vigorous urban middle class than much of the region. And it already has actually a pretty stable institutionalized electoral regime. Obviously not fully democratic for a bunch of reasons. But I think it's one case that with potential for democratization. Unfortunately, there are a number of cases in the Middle East that are very stable monarchies with strong Western support and a ton of petroleum rents, which makes democratization extremely difficult. So I would rule out the Gulf states. Then you have another set of cases where states have collapsed. It was a pipe dream to have expected democratization in Egypt, in Libya, and now in Syria, and also Yemen. I mean, these are now four cases where the state has effectively collapsed. If you have no state, there's no chance at all of democratization.
So how do U.S. leaders get it so wrong, especially the Bush administration, which was saying, you know, we're kind of making the Middle East safe for democracy?
I don't know. There were political scientists in the Bush administration high up. Condoleezza Rice was my professor at Stanford. There were smart people in that administration. But comparative politics scholars knew at the time and said at the time, before the invasion of Iraq, that this was what we call a sultanistic or neo-patrimonial regime, a regime in which the state was pretty tightly wound up with the figure of Saddam Hussein and his family and his inner circle, so that the state, particularly much of the coercive apparatus, was very tightly bound to him and his family and his inner circle and clan, such that if you were to chop off the head of a sultanistic regime, there is a serious danger of state collapse. And that's what happened. And that was entirely predictable.
What do you think that people need to realize here about, you know, when democracy is possible and when it isn't, and what the U.S. role should be in terms of, quote unquote, making the world safe for democracy, or just kind of leaving it alone and letting things happen until it becomes clear who's really moving in that direction?
Yeah, it's funny. I mean, idealistic democracy promotion goes way back, goes back certainly to the early part of the 20th century, where we made similar mistakes over and over again in Cuba, in Haiti, in Nicaragua, in Dominican Republic. We'd send in troops, topple a dictator, hold an election, and expect democracy. So democracy is pretty hard to promote from abroad, but it's particularly hard when you have no state, no functioning state to preserve a minimum of order. The few places where we have actually promoted democracy abroad through military intervention have been countries that have pretty effective states: Japan, Germany, Panama. Panama, 1989. If our military intervention knocks out the state at the same time that it knocks out the dictator, and that's what occurred in both Libya and Iraq, the chances for a subsequent democratization are very, very low.
So this is asking an opinion rather than just for analysis as an academic. But, I mean, do you think that the U.S. should be in the business of being proactive and trying to help states that are not democracies move to being democracies by way of military intervention?
It's very hard to do. I mean, I think that our historical record has been poor. And in a number of cases, it has produced very little gain and gotten us in trouble in terms of the U.S.'s international image and the like. And in other cases, things have gotten considerably worse as a result of military intervention. So I don't think you can make a blanket claim. there are in fact cases, maybe because of, you know, massive human rights violations, the potential for genocide, there may be instances where U.S. military intervention is warranted or can be defended on normative grounds. But historically, the record in terms of democracy promotion, I mean, the U.S. may have other goals when it intervenes. It may have geopolitical, strategic goals. But intervention for democratization's sake has rarely been successful.
And what about other kinds of non-military, non-violent interventions to help promote democracy? I mean, what do you think is effective? Is anything effective?
Yeah, I mean, it's effective at the margins. I mean, the foreign powers are very, very rarely decisive, but they can be effective at the margins. Particularly what I found in my book on competitive authoritarianism was that particularly countries that have very, very strong ties to the West, extensive ties, cultural ties, social ties, technocratic ties, meaning they're elite, all vacation in the United States or Western Europe. They all get educated there. They all hope to get a scholarship at Harvard or Oxford when they leave office. Their parties get funded by German foundations. Extensive political, diplomatic, economic, social, technocratic ties. Those are countries that are easiest to influence. And so Central Europe for the EU, the Caribbean basin, Mexico for the United States. And resources are another factor that can matter a lot. I mean, what's really critical for democratization or to bring down authoritarian regimes is that oppositions are able to organize, that oppositions are able to, say, compete in election and not only run candidates across the country, but campaign and pay for poll watchers in every precinct across the country. There are cases where, particularly in very low-income countries, where a relatively small amount of external support for human rights groups, for independent media, and for oppositions can go a long way. But again, it's at the margins. You can't, you know, U.S. intervention is not going to turn a Burundi into a Sweden.
And it sounds like the elites still need to be willing to allow an opposition to grow up, as was the case in Taiwan, but is not the case now in China.
Yes. I mean, in Taiwan, you had a case of a cohesive elite that decided that it was worth democratizing. And actually, the ties to the United States mattered a lot in that case. But most often, what's important is not that the elites decide something, but that the elites split. Whenever you have a cohesive authoritarian elite, and this is something that I think you still have in China, you rarely get democratization. There you really do need a massive protest movement from society, like you had, say, in South Africa or in Poland, to bring down the regime. But the best way to break an authoritarian regime down is for the elites to divide, for the elites to split.
So I wanted Bill Hurst to weigh in about China, since he knows it well. President Xi Jinping has been cracking down hard on any criticism of the government, telling the Chinese media that they exist to serve the Communist Party, and banning at universities discussion of what Xi Jinping considers the inappropriate Western ideas of democracy, human rights, civil society, and the rule of law. The government's even discouraging the use of Western textbooks in universities. So my question to Bill was, China's younger generation is used to being online and connected with the rest of the world. Many like Xi Jinping's crackdown on corruption, but what about the rest of it? Aren't pressures building up?
That's, of course, the million-dollar question. I think that the Chinese Communist Party certainly does not want to give up power, nor does it envision a future in which it can maintain power while radically changing the political system. And that is, Xi Jinping and others in power in China want to keep the status quo as far as the basic system is concerned. They're very, very concerned to be able to do that effectively, not necessarily to be able to do that in a pleasant way, but in an effective way. And so what we've seen since about 2007, and in a much more ramped up way since 2012, is in fact the augmentation of the security state and an increase, dramatic increase in political repression and a closing of previously open political and social spaces. To tighten up control rather than to loosen in anticipation of what I think many in the Chinese leadership feel could be a moment of potential crisis.
And do you think that's working? Do you think that people who were used to having more room to express opinions are going to be willing to accept this in the long run?
Well, I don't know how willing people will be, but I think they may have to, at least in the short run. In the long run, anything's possible. But in the very short run, it does seem to be a pretty effective policy of tightening up political and social control so far in China.
China's leaders hear the U.S. calls for democracy and human rights as code for push the American agenda, contain China. They look at what the U.S. government does and not just what it says. Even if they disagree that democracy is appropriate for all, and they do disagree, they've said bluntly and snidely that America's hardly been setting a shining example of late. But that doesn't mean that everyone in the Chinese leadership is ideologically in lockstep and against democracy. Though, with Xi Jinping at the helm, reformers are keeping quiet and biding their time. I ask Bill how long he thinks this can last, and if change is going to come in China, where would it come from?
You mean if China were to suddenly become not authoritarian or change its authoritarian stripes in some way?
Yeah. I mean, would it come from the elites within the party? Would it come from pressure from the population? Would it come from the economy sort of being in the doldrums for a long time? I mean, you know, what starts to make the wheels come off where suddenly another system of some kind looks better?
Well, I think there's two possibilities. One would be a truly existential crisis for the state and the party. You know, something along the lines of the country breaking up, or true economic collapse on a scale that we can't even really contemplate very clearly. I don't think that's very likely. I certainly hope that that's not likely for anyone's sake. But if something like that were to happen, when that happens in any given country, that often can precipitate the kind of crisis and then regime transition of one kind or another. And that's essentially what happened in Indonesia in 1997-98. It's similar to what happened in the Philippines in 1986. Something like that could happen in China, although I don't think it's likely. A more likely scenario for meaningful change in China would be that some members of the elite, at least, perceive that a crisis is brewing or likely if actions are not taken to change the political dynamic. And in that sense, I found very instructive what I was told by someone who had been a Central Committee member, who is not anymore, about 10 years ago, who argued that China at that time, this is about 2005-06, in his view, was rather similar to Taiwan in the 1970s. Or that the mainland of China was similar to the Taiwan regime of the 1970s. And I asked him, what do you mean by that? And are you implying that 10 or 15 years from now, there should be or could be some kind of meaningful political change in the People's Republic, such as we saw in the Taiwan government in the 1980s and early 90s? He said, yes, that's exactly what I'm implying. Now, obviously, he didn't continue to push for those positions. But I think that there are some people in the top elite who have views like that. And I think that as things continue to evolve, if enough people in the ruling elite perceive the likelihood of an impending crisis to be great enough, they may take steps along the lines that we saw in South Korea or in Taiwan 25 to 30 years ago. And change aspects of the political system and dynamic in much more liberal ways than we might anticipate from the outside. But I don't think that's imminent.
So one other sort of casting forward into the distant future question. Do you see any particular risks in this century that are new compared to the last one? You know, we're moving into more of a multipolar world. The United States is a little flat-footed in adjusting to that new multipolar world. China certainly feels that it should be its century. India has a young population and, you know, certainly potential to become a significant player even beyond what it is now. We've had a long stretch since the last World War. Hopefully there won't be another. But, I mean, are you seeing tensions building up as there is a conflict of philosophies of what the best way is to move forward as a multipolar world?
Well, that's an excellent question and not an easy one to answer. I do think that the 20th century, to a degree that was unprecedented, was characterized by great power conflict and contestation. And we can see this in the First World War, the Second World War, and the Cold War in a very, very clear and powerful way. In a way that really wasn't true in the 19th century, or certainly not in the 18th century or before. I don't see any reason to think that the 21st century is going to be similar. In other words, the 20th century may have been one paradigm, but not the new paradigm for the rest of history. That doesn't mean there won't be any conflict or contestation, but I think that what appears, at least in the first decade and a half of this century, to be much more of a real threat or concern is transnational violence of one kind or another, whether that's ISIS or Al-Qaeda or some other kind of drug cartels or, in other words, transnational violence that is not directly linked to states or to initiating some sort of revolution or regime change within states.
Although ISIS obviously would say that it does have a state and it's trying to create a bigger state. And, it's actually had some power to attract. Mm-hmm. And there have been times in history when there have been moves toward a more authoritarian direction for long stretches of time. Do you think something like that could happen in this century?
Well, like the first half of the 20th century, you mean? In the sense of many countries deciding to become more authoritarian than they had been, or at least, well, that may not be quite fair. I mean, the first half of the 20th century is really the birth of modern authoritarianism in a way that didn't exist before, in several different forms that didn't exist before. Most of those countries, though, were not liberal democracies prior to the first half of the 20th century. They were older authoritarian countries, sort of conservative monarchies of one kind or another. So it's not obvious that there's waves of authoritarianism to any greater degree than there are waves of democracy. If we see the first half of the 20th century as an authoritarian wave of a certain kind, even though it's monarchies turning into more modern authoritarian states, whether they're fascist, communist, or whatever they might be, and the second half of the 20th century maybe is a wave of democracy after the Second World War and then again in the 80s. Are we going to see another such wave? I don't know. But I don't know that either of those is really this kind of wave that we like to think of them as being.
I guess I didn't mean so much a wave in many countries so much as that ISIS would continue to attract.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think, ISIS certainly has attracted some people from all different countries. What I think is important to remember, though, is that they've not attracted more people than they have already. If we look at even very large countries, if we look at Indonesia, for example, when I was in Indonesia last fall, or fall of 2014, this would be, and I spent a while there recently, there was a lot of talk in the media and from many officials about tremendous concern over how many Indonesians may or may not have traveled to Syria to support ISIS. But as it turns out, by any estimation that I've heard, that number is actually very small, given that there are more than 200 million Muslim people in Indonesia who are being bombarded with propaganda from ISIS, supposedly, and are potentially recruitable from the ISIS point of view. The fact that a few hundred or even a few thousand maybe have been recruited is really impressive in that there have been so few who have found that attractive. And Indonesia is not the anomaly. I think it's more the rule around the world of majority Muslim countries.
And what about Africa's young and growing population and the leaders who govern them? Here's Stephen Levitsky.
Well, Africa has made politically tremendous progress relative to the 1970s and 1980s. There are not many full democracies in Africa. Ghana is a full democracy. South Africa is. Namibia is pretty close. Benin is a full democracy. The list doesn't extend much beyond that. But whereas 30, 40 years ago, the entire continent, almost the entire continent, was governed by single-party rule, by single-party dictatorships, now regimes are at least somewhat competitive. There are elections, there are opposition. Opposition sometimes wins. So it's not a place with a large number of full democracies, but it's whereas it used to be almost entirely authoritarian, Africa is now full of hybrid regimes, electoral regimes with at least some level of competition. And obviously, one key is prosperity and growth of a larger middle class, growth of a larger private sector, the growth of a larger civil society. Without those things, it's very, very hard to sustain democracy. But the other thing that's critical is building effective states. And one of the things that really hit Africa very hard in the 1990s was the collapse of states, the severe fiscal crisis, in many cases, the loss of external support. With the end of the Cold War, very large number of African states either collapsed entirely, like Zaire, which became Congo, Sierra Leone, Liberia, or just weakened to the point of borderline dysfunctionality. It's, again, very, very hard to sustain a democracy with a really weak state. And that's still a problem in at least half of sub-Saharan African countries.
So a lot of variables are at play amongst state and non-state actors between liberal and illiberal tendencies. Given the tugs in opposing directions, I asked Stephen Levitsky if he thinks there's a hard ceiling to how many democracies there are likely to be in the world in this century. Now there are about 89. How much can that number grow in this century, or might it shrink?
Look, I'm certainly not someone who believes in a kind of a unidirectional history, or that, you know, we're all headed eventually towards some liberal democratic outcome. History changes, and the world changes in ways that we can't always predict, and geopolitics will matter a ton. And so, you know, one of the reasons why we saw such a tremendous burst of democratization in the 1990s was the fact that the Soviet Union collapsed and the United States and the liberal West, the U.S. plus Western Europe, emerged for about a decade as really virtually hegemonic, militarily, economically, ideologically. That has passed, and we're probably not going to return in the near future to a unipolar world like that. But we don't know what the relationship among Europe, China, India, the United States, Brazil is going to be like in 30, 40, 50 years. So it's very, very hard to say. Even though I don't think there's a democratic recession, it's very clear that the expansion of democratization stalled around 2005. That's because the cases that remain, with a few exceptions, Singapore, Malaysia, Venezuela, Thailand, the cases that remain are really hard nuts. They're countries that are incredibly poor, that have collapsed states, that are these massive rentier states. There's a good reason why the number is not growing. These are really hard nuts.
So given all this, how might the balance play out in this century between authoritarianism and democracy around the world? Bill Hurst has some thoughts.
Well, in terms of who's going to hold sway in the decades ahead, that's really difficult to tell. What I think is likely is that the relative position of both the United States and China compared to other parts of the world is not likely to become stronger. In other words, these are two countries that one of which sees itself as a superpower, the other would like to be seen as a superpower, but neither one is likely to remain as much of a superpower as it is today in the decades ahead. Does that mean that there are other countries that are going to replace them? I don't think so. I don't think suddenly that, you know, India or Russia is going to become a bigger power than China or the United States. But I think in this sense, a lot of thinkers in China, in fact, and scholars of international relations probably have it right in that what we're headed for is a multipolar world, rather than a unipolar world dominated by the United States or bipolar competition like the Cold War. And I think the United States has been very good at fighting a bipolar competition. And everything that the United States as a world power was engineered to do coming out of the Second World War was to fight a bipolar competition. And it did that very, very well for many decades. And I think once that competition ended, the U.S. has struggled to adapt to what it saw as an emerging sort of unilateral domination of the world, let alone a multipolar world in which many different powers have to work together. And I think for the U.S. most effectively to promote its values or its agenda or sort of world stability and peace, the best thing the U.S. could do would be to learn to work collaboratively in a multipolar setting, which I think will be very hard for the United States to do, but not impossible. And the real question is not whether the U.S. can do that, but whether it wants to.
It's certainly not the message that Donald Trump and Ted Cruz are spreading in their presidential campaigns. Stephen Levitsky says populism of the sort Trump is tapping into was part of what eroded democracy in Thailand and Venezuela, and it worries him as a citizen.
You know, when you study Latin America, when you study democratization in Latin America, you focus a lot on, or you learn to focus a lot on the informal rules of the game that make democracy work. It's not just about the rules that you write down in the Constitution, but the informal rules by which elites play, and in which, you know, they, one side accepts the other as a legitimate opponent. Winners don't overly abuse their power. Losers accept that winners win and are able to govern. There are basic norms, essentially, of the democratic game that are necessary to make democracy work. And I've been having these discussions with Latin Americans for decades, and now in the last decade, we see in the United States these very norms beginning to be eroded. You know, for decades, the Senate allowed presidents to appoint nominees, judiciary and elsewhere. Suddenly, that is up for grabs. For decades and decades, or for many years, the filibuster was something that was used only in exceptional circumstances. Suddenly, it became something that was used routinely. And now, even more dangerously, for the first time in my lifetime, accepting a level of violence in the political discourse. It had been a no-brainer, even for, you know, the most extreme candidates, Jesse Jackson on the left, Ronald Reagan on the right in the 1980s. It was unthinkable that you would ever accept violent rhetoric. And yeah, it frightens me.
So what next for the United States and its ability to lead by example? Depends, of course, on how things unfold in the next election, in the next Congress, and in the next Supreme Court. Full democracies do have a history of being resilient, but they can stumble and they can erode. And if the global balance is going to tilt toward democracy rather than the historical default of authoritarianism, leading by example has a better track record of turning the tide. And that's our podcast. For more, visit our website at pri.org/century, where you'll also find past episodes, including one on how a study suggests that authoritarian tendencies among American voters most strongly correlates with whether they support Donald Trump. You can also subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, please do, and leave a review while you're there. We're also on SoundCloud, Stitcher, and most other podcast apps. I tweet at Mary Kay Magstad, that's MaryKayMagistad, all one word. Whose Century Is It? Is a co-production between me and PRI's The World in cooperation with the BBC and WGBH. It's funded by a grant from the Henry Luce Foundation. I'll be back in a couple of weeks with another episode. Come on back and listen in.